Welcome to Discourses Upon the Existence and Attributes of God, Volume 1 by Stephen Charnock. We are continuing to read at page 574 for this reading. This Reformation MP3 audio resource is a production of Stillwater's Revival Books. Many free resources, as well as our complete online catalogue, containing classic and contemporary Puritan and Reformed books, DVDs, CDs, digital downloads, MP3s, and much more at great discounts, are on the web at www.swrb.com. Also, please consider, pray, and act upon the important truths found in the following quotation by Charles Spurgeon. As the Apostle says to Timothy, so also he says to everyone, give yourself to reading. He will not use the thoughts of other men's brains, proves that he has no brains of his own. You need to read. Renounce as much as you will all like literature, but study as much as possible sound theological works, especially the Puritanic writers and expositions of the Bible. The best way for you to spend your leisure is to be either reading or praying. And now to SWRB's reading of the existence and attributes of God, which we hope you find to be a great blessing, and which we pray draws you nearer to the Lord Jesus Christ. For he is the way, the truth, and the life, and no man cometh unto the Father but by him. John 14, verse 6. Nine. This wisdom of God is manifest in the manner of the publishing and propagating this doctrine of redemption. 1. In the gradual discoveries of it. Flashing a great light in the face of a sudden is amazing. Should the sun glare in our eye in all its brightness on a sudden, after we have been in thick darkness, it would blind us instead of comforting us. So great a work as this must have had several digestions. God first reveals of what seed the redeeming person should be. The seed of the woman, Genesis 3:15. Then of what nation, Genesis 26:4. Then of what tribe, Genesis 49:12. Of the tribe of Judah. Then of what family, the family of David. Then what works he was to do, what sufferings to undergo. The first predictions of our Saviour were obscure. Adam could not well see the redemption in the promise for the punishment of death, which succeeded in the threatening. The promise exercises faith, and the obscurity and bodily death is humility. The promise made to Abraham was clearer than the revelations made before, yet he could not tell how to reconcile his redemption with his exile. God supported his faith by the promise, and exercised his humility by making him a pilgrim, and keeping him in a perpetual dependence upon him in all his motions. The declarations to Moses are brighter than those to Abraham. The delineations of Christ by David in the Psalms, more illustrious than the former, and all those exceeded by the revelations made to the prophet Isaiah and the other prophets, according as the age did approach wherein the Redeemer was to enter into his office. God wrapped up this gospel in a multitude of types and ceremonies fitted to the infant state of the church, Galatians 4:3. An infant state is usually affected with sensible things, yet all those ceremonies were fitted to that great end of the gospel, which he would bring forth in time to the world. And the wisdom of God in them would be amazing if we could understand the analogy between every economy in the law and the things signified by it, as it cannot but affect a diligent reader to observe that little account of them we have by the Apostle Paul, sprinkled in his epistles, and more largely in that to the Hebrews. As the political laws of the Jews flowed from the depths of the moral law, so their ceremonial did from the depths of evangelical councils, and all of them had a special relation to the honor of God and the debasing of the creature. Though God formed the mass and matter of the world at the first creation at once, yet his wisdom took 6 days' time for the disposing and adorning it. The more illustrious truths of God are not to be comprehended on a sudden by the weakness of men. Christ did not declare all truths to his disciples in the time of his life, because they were not able at that present to bear them. John 16:12. Ye cannot bear them now. Some were reserved for his resurrection, others for the coming of the Spirit, and the full discovery of all kept back for another world. This doctrine God figured out in the law, oracled by the prophets, and unveiled by Christ and his apostles. 2. The wisdom of God appeared in using all proper means to render the belief of it easy. 1. The most minute things that were to be transacted were predicted in the ancient foregoing age, long before the coming of the Redeemer, the vinegar and gall offered to him upon the cross, the parting his garments, the not breaking of his bones, the piercing of his hands and feet, the betraying of him, the slighting of him by the multitude, all were exactly painted and represented in variety of figures. There was light enough to good men not to mistake him, and yet not so plain as to hinder bad men from being serviceable to the counsel of God in the crucifying of him when he came. 2. In the translation of the Old Testament from the private language of the Jews into the most public language of the world, that translation which we call Septuagint, from Hebrew into Greek, some years before the coming of Christ, that tongue being most diffused at that time, by reason of the Macedonian Empire raised by Alexander and the University of Athens, to which other nations resorted for learning and education. This was a preparation for the sons of Japheth to dwell in the tents of Shem. By this was the entertainment of the gospel facilitated, when they compared the prophecies of the Old Testament with the declarations of the New, and found things so long predicted before they were transacted in the public view. 3. By ordering concurrent testimonies as to matter of fact, that the matter of fact was not deniable, that there was such a person as Christ, that his miracles were stupendous, that his doctrine did not incline to sedition, that he affected not worldly applause, that he did suffer at Jerusalem, was acknowledged by all. Not a man among the greatest enemies of Christians was found that denied the matter of fact. And this great truth, that Christ is the Messiah and Redeemer, had been with universal consent owned by all the professors of Christianity throughout the world, whatever bickerings there have been among them about some particular doctrines, they all centered in the truth of Christ being the Redeemer. The first publication of this doctrine was sealed by 1,000 miracles, and so illustrious that he was an utter stranger to the world that was ignorant of them. 4. In keeping up some principles and opinions in the world to facilitate the belief of this, or render man inexcusable for objecting of it. The incarnation of the Son of God could not be so strange to the world if we consider the general belief of the appearances of their gods among them, that the Epicureans and others that denied any such appearances were counted atheists, and Pythagoras was esteemed to be one not of the inferior genii and lunar demons, but one of the higher gods, who appeared in the human body by the curing and rectifying mortal life, and himself tells Abaris the Scythian that he took the flesh of man, that men might not be astonished at him, and in a fright fly from his imagination instructions. It was not therefore accounted an irrational thing among them that God should be incarnate, but indeed the great stumbling block was a crucified God. But had they known the holy and righteous nature of God, the malice of sin, the universal corruption of human nature, the first threatening, the necessity of vindicating the honour of the law, and clearing the justice of God, the notion of his crucifixion would not have appeared so incredible, since they believed the possibility of an incarnation. Another principle was that universal one of sacrifices for expiation, and rendering God propitious to man, and was practiced amongst all nations. I remember not anywhere in this custom did not prevail, for it did even among those people where the Jews, as being no trading nation, had not any commerce, and also in America found out in these latter ages. It was not a law of nature, No man can find any such written in his own heart, but a tradition from Adam. Now that among the loss of so many other doctrines that were handed down from Adam to his immediate posterity, as, in particular, that of the seed of the woman, which one would think a necessary appendix to that of sacrificing, this latter should be preserved as a fragment of our ancient tradition, seems to be an act of divine wisdom. To prepare men for the entertainment of the doctrine of the great sacrifice for the expiation of the sin of the world. And as the apostle forms his argument from the Jewish sacrifices in the epistle to the Hebrews, for convincing them of the end of the death of Christ, so did the ancient fathers make use of this practice of the heathen to convince them of the same doctrine. 5. The wisdom of God appeared in the time and circumstances of the first solemn publication of the gospel by the apostles at Jerusalem. The relation you may read in Acts 2:1-12. The Spirit was given to the apostles on the day of Pentecost, a time when there were multitudes of Jews from all nations, not only near but remote, that heard the great things of God spoken in the several languages of those nations where their habitations were fixed, and that by 12 illiterate men that 2 or 3 hours before knew no language but that of their native country. It was the custom of the Jews that dwelt among other nations at a distance from Jerusalem to assemble together at Jerusalem at the feast of Pentecost. And God pitched upon this season that there might be witnesses to this miracle, of this miracle in many parts of the world. There were some of every nation under heaven, verse 5, that is, of that known part of the world, so saith the text. 14 several nations are mentioned, and proselytes as well as Jews by birth. They are called devout men, men of conscience, whose testimony would carry weight with it among their neighbours at their return, because of their reputation by their religious carriage. Again, this was not heard and seen by some of them at one time, and some at another, by some 1 hour, by others the next successively, but all together, in the solemn assembly, that the testimony of so many witnesses at a time might be more valid, and the truth of their doctrine appear more illustrious and undeniable. It must needs be astonishing to them to hear that person magnified in so miraculous a manner who had so lately been condemned by their countrymen as a malefactor. Wisdom consists in the timing of things, and in a circumstance does the wisdom of God appear, in furnishing the apostles with the Spirit at such a time, and bringing forth such a miracle as the gift of tongues on a sudden, that every nation might hear in their own language the wonder of redemption, and as witnesses at their returns to their own countries report it to others, that the credit they had in their several places might facilitate the belief and entertainment of the gospel when the apostles or others should arrive to those several charges and diocese appointed for them to preach the gospel in. Had this miracle been wrought in the presence only of the inhabitants of Judea, that they had understood only in their own language, or one or two of the neighbouring tongues, it had been counted by them rather a madness than a miracle. Or had they understood all the tongues which they spoke, the news of it had spread no further than the limits of their own habitations, and had been confined within the narrow bounds of the land of Judea. But now it is carried to several remote nations, where any of those auditors then assembled had their residence. As God chose the time of the Passover for the death of Christ, that there might be the greatest number of the inhabitants of the country, as witnesses of the matter of fact, the innocence and sufferings of Christ, so he chose the time of Pentecost for the first publishing the value and end of this blood to the world. Thus the evangelical law was given in a confluence of people from all parts and nations, because it was a covenant with all nations, and the variety of languages spoken by a company of poor Galileans, bred up at the lake of Tiberias, and in poor corners of Canaan, without the instructions of men for so great a skill, might well evidence to the hearers that God that brought the confusion of languages first at Babel did only work that cure of them and combine all together at Jerusalem. 3. The wisdom of God is seen in the instruments he employed in the publishing the gospel. He did not employ philosophers, but fishermen. Used not acquired arts, but infused wisdom and courage. This treasure was put into and preserved in earthen vessels, that the wisdom, as well as the power of God, might be magnified. The weaker the means are which attain the end, the greater is the skill of the conductor of them. Wise princes choose men of most credit, interest, wisdom, and ability to be ministers of their affairs and ambassadors to others. But what were those that God chose so great a work, as a publishing a new doctrine to the world? What was their quality but mean? What was their authority without interest? What was their ability without eminent parts or so great a work, but that what divine grace in a special manner endowed them with? Nay, what was their disposition to it, as dull and unwieldy? Witness the frequent rebukes for their slow-heartedness from their master when he conversed in the flesh with them. And one of the greatest of them, so fond of the Jewish ceremonies and Pharisaical principles, wherein he had been more than ordinarily principled, that he hated the Christian religion to extirpation, and the professors of it to death, by whose ways which were out of the road of human wisdom, and would be accounted the greatest absurdity to be practiced by men that have a repute for discretion, did God advance his wisdom. 1 Corinthians 1:25. The foolishness of God is wiser than man. By this means it was indisputably evidenced to unbiased minds that the doctrine was divine. It could not rationally be imagined that instruments destitute of all human advantages should be able to vanquish the world, confound Judaism, overturn heathenism, chase away the devils, strip them of their temples, alienate the minds of men from their several religions, which have been rooted in them by education and established by a long succession. It could not, I say, reasonably be imagined to be without a supernatural assistance, an heavenly and efficacious working, whereas had God taken a course agreeable to the prudence of man, and used those that had been furnished with learning, tipped with eloquence, and armed with human authority, the doctrines would have been thought to have been of human invention, and to be some subtle contrivance for some unworthy and ambitious end. The nothingness and weakness of the instruments manifest them to be conducted by divine power, and declare the doctrine itself to be from heaven. When we see such feeble instruments proclaim the doctrine repugnant to flesh and blood, sending forth a crucified Christ to be believed in and trusted on, and declaiming against the religion and worship under which the Roman Empire had long flourished, exhorting them to the contempt of the world, preparing for afflictions, denying themselves and their own honours by the hopes of an unseen reward, things so repugnant to flesh and blood, and these instruments concurring in the same story with an admirable harmony in all parts, and sealing this doctrine with their blood. Can we upon all this ascribe this doctrine to a human contrivance, or fix any lower author of it than the wisdom of heaven? It is the wisdom of God that carries on his own designs in methods most suitable to his own greatness, and different from the customs and modes of men, that less of humanity and more of divinity might appear. 4. The wisdom of God appears in the ways and manner, as well as in the instruments of its propagation, by ways seemingly contrary. You know how God had sent the Jews into captivity in Babylon, and though he struck off their chains and restored them to their country, yet many of them had no mind to leave a country wherein they had been born and bred. The distance from the place of the original of their ancestors, and their affection to the country wherein they were born, might have occasioned their embracing the illustrious worship of the place. Afterwards, the persecutions of Antiochus scattered many of the Jews for their security into their other nations, yet a great part, and perhaps the greatest, preserved their religion, and by that were obliged to come every year to Jerusalem to offer, and so were present at the effusion of the Spirit on the day of Pentecost, and were witnesses of the miraculous effects of it. Had they not been dispersed by persecution, had they not resided in several countries, and been acquainted with their languages, the gospel had not so easily been diffused into several countries of the world. The first persecutions also raised against the church propagated the gospel. The scattering of the disciples inflamed with courage and dispersed the doctrine, Acts 8:3, according to the prophecy of Daniel 12:4, many should run to and fro, and knowledge should be increased. The flights and hurryings of men should enlarge the territories of the gospel. There was not a tribunal, but the primitive Christians were cited to. Not a horrible punishment, but was inflicted upon them. Treated they were as dregs and offals of mankind, as the common enemies of the world. Yet the flames of the martyrs brightened the doctrine, and the captivity of its professors made way for the throne of its empire. The imprisonment of the Ark was the downfall of Dagon. Religion grew stronger by sufferings, and Christianity taller by injuries. What can this be ascribed to, but the conduct of a wisdom superior to that of men and devils, defeating the methods of human and hellish policy, thereby making the wisdom of this world foolishness with God, 1 Corinthians 3:19. 5. The use, 1, of information. If wisdom be an excellency of the divine nature, then, 1, Christ's deity may hence be asserted. Wisdom is the emphatical title of Christ in Scripture, Proverbs 8:12-13-31, where wisdom is brought in speaking as a distinct person, ascribing counsel and understanding, and the knowledge of witty inventions to itself. He is called also the power of God and the wisdom of God, 1 Corinthians 1:24. And the ancients generally understood that place, Colossians 2:3, in him are hid all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge, as an assertion of the Godhead of Christ, in regard to the infiniteness of his knowledge, referring wisdom to his knowledge of divine things, and knowledge to his understanding of all human things. But the natural sense of the place seems to be this, that all wisdom and knowledge is displayed by Christ in the gospel, and the words refer either to Christ or the mystery of God spoken of, verse 2. But the deity of Christ, in regard of infinite wisdom, may be deduced from his creation of things and his government of things, but both which are ascribed to him in Scripture. The first ascribed to him, John 1:3, all things were made by him, and verse 27, without him was not made, not anything made that was made. The second, John 5:22, the Father hath committed all judgment to the Son, and both put together, Colossians 2:16-17. Now since he hath the government of the world, he hath the perfections necessary to so great a work. As the creation of the world, which is ascribed to him, requires an infinite power, so the government of the world requires an infinite wisdom. That he hath the knowledge of the hearts of men was proved in handling the omniscience of God. That knowledge would be of too little purpose without wisdom to order the motions of men's hearts, and conduct all the qualities and actions of creatures to such an end as is answerable to a wise government. We cannot think so great an employment can be without an ability necessary for it. The government of men and angels is a great part of the glory of God, and if God should entrust the greatest part of his glory in hands unfit for so great a trust, it would be an argument of weakness in God, as it is in men, to pitch upon unfit instruments for particular charges, since God hath therefore committed to him his greatest glory, the conduct of all things for the highest end. He hath a wisdom requisite for so great an end, which can be no less than infinite. If then Christ were a finite person, he would not be capable of an infinite communication. It could not be a subject wherein infinite wisdom could be lodged. For the terms finite and infinite are so distant that they cannot commence one another. Finite can never be changed into infinite, no more than infinite can into finite. 2. Hence we may assert the right and fitness of God for the government of the world, as he is the wisest being. Among men, those who are excellent in judgment are accounted fittest to preside over and give orders to others. The wisest in the city are most capable to govern a city. Or at least, though ignorant men may bear the title, yet the advice of the soundest and skillfulest heads should prevail in all public affairs. We see in nature that the eye guides the body, and the mind directs the eye. Power and wisdom are the two arms of authority. Wisdom knows the end and directs the means. Power executes the means designed for an end. The more splendid and strong those are in any, the more authority results from thence. For the conduct of others that are of an inferior orb, now God being infinitely excellent in both, his ability and right to the management of the world cannot be suspected. The whole world is but one commonwealth, whereof God is the monarch. Did the government of the world depend upon the election of men and angels, where could they pitch, or where would they find perfections capable of so great a work, but in the supreme wisdom? His wisdom hath already been apparent in those laws, whereby he formed the world into a civil society, and the Israelites into a commonwealth. The one suited to the consciences and the reasons of all his subjects, and the other suited to the genius of that particular nation, drawn out of the righteousness of the moral law, and applicable to all cases that might arise among them in their government. So that Moses asserts that the wisdom apparent in their laws, enacted by God as their chief magistrate, would render them famous among other nations, in regard of their wisdom, as well as their righteousness. Deuteronomy 4, 6, 7, 9. Also this perfection doth evidence that God doth actually govern the world. It would not be a commendable thing for a man to make a curious piece of clockwork, and take no care for the orderly motion of it. Would God display so much of his skill in framing the heaven and earth, and none in actual guidance of them to their particular and universal ends? Did he lay the foundation in order, and fit every stone in the building, make all things in weight and measure, to let them afterward run at haphazard? Would he bring forth his power to view in the creation, and let more glorious perfection lie idle, when it has so large a field to move in? Infinite wisdom is inconsistent with inactivity. All prudence doth illustrate itself in untying the hardest knots, and disposing the most difficult affairs to a happy and successful issue. All those various arts and inventions among men which lend their assisting hand to one another, and those various employments their several geniuses lead them to, whereby they support one another's welfare, are beings and instincts of divine wisdom in the government of the world. He that made all things in wisdom, Psalm 104:24, would not leave his works to act and move only according to their own folly, and idly behold them jumbled together, and run counter to the end he designed them for. We must not fancy divine wisdom to be destitute of activity. 3. We may see a ground of God's patience. The most impotent persons are the most impatient. When unforeseen emergencies arise, or at events expected by them, when their feeble prudence was not a sufficient match to contest with them or prevent them. But the wiser any man is, the more he bears with those things which seem to cross his intentions, because he knows he grasps the whole affair, and is sure of attaining the end he proposes to himself. Yet as a finite wisdom can have but a finite patience, so an infinite wisdom possesses an infinite patience. The wise God intends to bring glory to himself, and good to some of his creatures, out of the greatest evils that can happen in the world. He beholds no exorbitant afflictions and monstrous actions, but what he can dispose to a good and glorious end, even to work together for good to them that love God, Romans 8:28, and therefore doth not presently fall foul upon the actors, till he hath wrought out that temporary glory to himself, and good to all his people which he designs. The times of God, ignorance God winked at, till he had brought his Son into the world, and manifested his wisdom in redemption. And when this was done, he presseth men to a speedy repentance, Acts 17:30, that as he forbore punishment in their crimes, in order to the displaying his wisdom in the designed redemption, so when he had effected it, they must forbear any longer abusing his patience. 4. Hence appears the immutability of God in his decrees. He is not destitute of the power and strength to change his own purposes, but his infinite perfection of wisdom is a bar to his laying aside his eternal resolves and forming new ones. Isaiah 46:10. He resolves the end from the beginning, and his counsel stands immovable, because it is his counsel. It is an impotent counsel that is subject to a daily thwarting itself. Inconstant persons are accounted by men destitute of due measure of prudence. If God changes his mind, it is either for the better or the worse. If for the better, he was not wise in his former purpose. If for the worse, he is not wise in his present resolve. No alteration can be without a reflection of weakness upon the former or present determination. God must either cease to be wise as he was before, or begin to be wiser than he was before the change, which to think or imagine is to deny a deity. If any man change his resolution, he is apprehensive of a flaw in his former purpose, and finds an inconvenience in it, which moves him to such a change, which must be either for want of foresight in himself, or want of a due consideration of the object of his counsel, neither of which can be imagined of God without a denial of the deity. No, there can be no blots and blemishes in his purposes and promises. Repentance indeed is an act of wisdom in the creature, but it supposes folly in his former actions, which is inconsistent with infinite perfection. Men are often too rash in promising, and therefore what they promise in haste, they perform at leisure, or not at all. They consider not before they vow, and make after inquiries whether they had best stand to it. The only wise God needs not whether they had best. The only wise God needs not any after gain. As he is sovereignly wise, he sees no cause of reversing anything, and wants not expedients for his own purpose. And as he is infinitely powerful, he hath no superior to hinder him from executing his will, and making his people enjoy the effects of his wisdom. If he had a recollection of thoughts, as man hath, and he saw a necessity to mend them, if he were not infinitely wise in his first decrees, as in creation he looked back upon the several pieces of that goodly frame he had erected, and saw them so exact that he did not take up his pencil again to mend any particle of first drought, so his promises are made with such infinite wisdom and judgment, that what he writes is irreversible and forever, as the decrees of the Medes and Persians. All the words of God are eternal, because they are births of righteousness and judgment. Hosea 2:19, I will betroth thee to me forever in righteousness and judgment. He is not of a wavering and flitting discretion. If he threatens, he wisely considers what he threatens. If he promises, he wisely considers what he promises. And therefore, he is immutable in both. 5. Hence it follows that God is a fit object for our trust and confidence. For God, being infinitely wise, when he promises anything, he sees everything which may hinder, and everything which may promote the execution of it, so that he cannot discover anything afterwards that may move him to take up after thoughts. He hath more wisdom than to promise anything hand over head, or anything which he knows he cannot accomplish. Though God is true, be object of our trust, yet God is wise, is the foundation of our trust. We trust him in his promise. The promise was made by mercy, and it is performed by truth, but wisdom conducts all means to the accomplishment of it. There are many men whose honesty we can confide in, but whose discretion we are diffident of. But there is no defect, either the one or the other, which may scare us from a depending upon God in our concerns. The words of man's wisdom and apostle entitles enticing, 1 Corinthians 2:4, in opposition to the words of God's wisdom, which are firm, stable, and undeniable demonstrations. As the power of God is an encouragement of trust, because he is able to effect, so the wisdom of God comes into the rank of those attributes which support our faith. To put a confidence in him, we must be persuaded, not only that he is ignorant of nothing in the world, but that he is wise to manage the whole course of nature, and dispose of all his creatures, for the bringing his purposes and his promises to their designed perfection. 6. Hence appears the necessity of a public review of the management of the world and of a day of judgment. As a day of judgment may be inferred from many attributes of God and his sovereignty, justice, omniscience, etc., so among the rest from this of wisdom. How much of this perfection will lie unveiled and obscured if the sins of men be not brought to view, whereby the ordering the unrighteous actions of men, by his directing and overruling hand of providence, is in subserviency to his own purposes and his people's good, may appear in all its glory. Without such a public review, this part of wisdom will not be clearly visible. How those actions, which had a vile foundation in the hearts and designs of men, and were formed there to gratify some base lust, ambition, and covetousness, were by a secret wisdom presiding over them, conducted to amazing ends. It is a part of divine wisdom to right itself and convince men of the reasonableness of its laws and the unreasonableness of their contradictions to it. The execution of the sentence is an act of justice, but the conviction of the reasonableness of the sentence is an act of wisdom, clearing up the righteousness of the proceeding, and this precedes, and the other follows, Jude 15, to cleanse all that are ungodly of all their ungodly deeds. That wisdom which contrives satisfaction, as well as that justice which required it, is concerned in writing the law which was enacted by it. The wisdom of a sovereign lawgiver is engaged not to see his law vilified and trampled on, and exposed to the lusts and affronts of men, without being concerned in vindicating the honour of it. It would appear a folly to enact and publish it, if there were not a resolution to write and execute it. The wisdom of God can no more associate iniquity and happiness together than the justice of God can separate iniquity from punishment. It would be effective if it did not always tamely bear the insolence of offenders, without a time of remark of their crimes and a justification of the precept rebelliously spurned at. He would be unwise if he were unjust, and righteousness had no better title in Scripture than that of folly. It is no part of wisdom to give birth to those laws which will always be held ineffectual, and neither vindicate his law by a due execution of the penalty, nor right his own authority, condemned in the violation of his law, by a just revenge. Besides, what wisdom would it be for sovereign judge to lodge such a spokesman for himself as conscience in the soul of man, if it should be alway found speaking, and at length be found false in all that it speaks? There is therefore an apparent prospect of the day of account, from the consideration of this perfection of the divine nature. 7. Hence we have a ground for a mighty reverence and veneration of the divine majesty. Who can contemplate the sparklings of this perfection in the variety of the works of his hands, and the exact government of all his creatures, without a raised admiration of the excellency of his being, and a falling flat before him, in a posture of reverence to so great a being, can we behold so great a mass of matter, digested into several forms, so exact a harmony and temperament in all the creatures, the proportions of numbers and measures, and one creature answering the ends and designs of another, distinct beauties of all, the perpetual motion of all things without checking one another, the variety of the nature of things, and all acting according to their nature, with an admirable agreement, and all together, like different strings upon an instrument, emitting divers sounds, but all reduced to order in one delightful lesson. I say, can we behold all this without admiring and adoring the divine wisdom which appears in all? And from the consideration of this, let us pass to the consideration of his wisdom in redemption, in reconciling divided interests, and tying hard knots, drawing one contrary out of the other, another. And we must needs acknowledge that the wisdom of all men on earth, and angels in heaven, is worse than nothing in vanity in comparison of this vast ocean. Unless we have a great esteem for those that invent some excellent artificial engines, what reverence ought we to have for him that has stamped an inimitable wisdom upon all his works? Nature orders us to give honour to our superiors in knowledge, and confide in their counsels, but none ought to be reverenced as much as God, since none equals him in wisdom. 8. If God be infinitely wise, it shows us the necessity of our address to him, an invocation of his name. We are subject to mistakes, and often overseen. We are not able rightly to counsel ourselves. In some cases, all creatures are too short-sighted to apprehend them, and too ignorant to give advice proper for them, and to contrive remedies for their ease. But with the Lord there is counsel. Jeremiah 32:19. He is great in counsel, and mighty in working. Great in counsel to advise us, mighty in working to assist us. We know not how to effect a design, or prevent an expected evil. We have an infinite wisdom to go to, that is every way skillful to manage any business we desire, to avert any evil we fear, to accomplish anything we commit into his hands. When we know not what to resolve, he hath a counsel to guide us. Psalm 73:24. He has not more power to sure effect what is needful than wise to direct what is fitting. All men stand in need of the help of God, as one man stands in need of the assistance of other men, and will not do anything without advice, and he that takes advice deserves the title of wise man, as well as he that gives advice. But no man needs so much the advice of another man, as all men need the counsel and assistance of God. Neither is any man's wit and wisdom so far inferior to prudence and ability of an angel, as the wisdom of the highest man and the most sharp-sighted angel is inferior to the infinite wisdom of God. We see, therefore, that it is best for us to go to the fountain, and not content ourselves with the streams, to beg advice from a wisdom that is infinite and infallible, rather than from that which is finite and fallible. Use 2. If wisdom be the perfection of the divine majesty, how prodigious is the contempt of it in the world? In general, all sin strikes at this attitude, and it is in one part or other a degrading of it. The first sin directed its venom against this. As the devils endeavoured to equal their Creator in power, so man endeavoured to equal him in wisdom. Both indeed scorned to be ruled by his order, but man evidently exalted himself against the wisdom of God, and aspired to be a sharer with him in his infinite knowledge. Would not let him be the only wise God, but cherished an ambition to be his partner. Just as if a being were able to imagine it might be as bright as the sun, or a spark fancy it could be as full fraught with heat as the whole element of fire. Man could not submit to the infinite wisdom of God in the prohibition of one single fruit in the garden, when by the right of his sovereign authority he might have granted him only the use of one. All presumptuous sins are of this nature. They are therefore called reproaches of God. Numbers 15:30. The soul that doth aught presumptuously reproaches the Lord. All reproaches are either for natural, moral, or intellectual defects. All reproaches of God must imply a weakness or unrighteousness in God. If unrighteousness, his holiness is denied. If weakness, his wisdom is blemished. In general, all sin strikes at this perfection two ways. One, as it defaceth the wise workmanship of God. Every sin is a deforming and blemishing our own souls, which, as they are the prime creatures in the lower world, so they have greater characters of divine wisdom in the fabric of them. But this image of God is ruined and broken by sin. Though the spoiling of it be a scorn of his holiness, it is also an affront to his wisdom. For though his power was the cause of the production of so fair a peace, yet his wisdom was the guide of his power, and his holiness the pattern whereby he wrought it. His power affected it, and his holiness was exemplified in it, but his wisdom contrived it. If a man had a curious clock or watch, would it cost him many years' pains and strength of his skill to frame it? For another, after he had seen and considered it, to trample upon it, and crush it in pieces, would argue a contempt of the artificer's skill. God has shown infinite art in the creation of man, but sin unbeautifies man, and ravisheth his excellency. It cuts and slasheth the image of God, stamped by divine wisdom, as though it were an object only of scorn and contempt. The sinner in every act, every sin acts as if he intended to put himself in a better posture and in a fairer dress than the wisdom of God hath put him in by creation. 2. In the slighting his laws. The laws of God are highly rational. They are drawn from the depths of the divine understanding, wherein there is no unclearness and no defect. As his understanding apprehends all things in their true reason, so his will enjoins all things for worthy and wise ends. His laws are contrived by his wisdom for the happiness of man, whose happiness and the methods to it he understands better than men or angels can do. His laws being the orders of the wisest understanding, every breach of his law is a flying in the face of his wisdom. All human laws, though they are enforced by sovereign authority, yet they are, or ought to be, in the composing of them, founded upon reason, and should be particular applications of the law of nature to this or that particular emergency. The laws of God, then, who is summa ratio, are the birth of the truest reason, though the reason of every one of them may not be so clear to us. Every law, though it consists in an act of the will, yet doth presuppose an act of the understanding. The act of the divine understanding in framing the law must be supposed to precede the act of his will in commanding the observance of that law. So every sin against the law is not only against the will of God commanding, but the reason of God contriving, and a cleaving to our own reason rather than the understanding or mind of God. And if God had mistaken in making his law, and we had more understanding to frame a better and more conducing to our happiness, and if God were not wise enough to govern us and prescribe what we should do and what we should avoid, as if he designed not our welfare but our misfortune. Whereas the precepts of God are not tyrannical edicts or acts of mere will, but the fruits of counsel. And therefore every breach of them is a real declaration against his discretion and judgment, and preferring our own imaginations or the suggestions of the devil as our rule before the results of divine counsel. While we acknowledge him wise in our opinion, we speak him foolish by our practice, when instead of being guided by him, we will guide ourselves. No man will question, but it is a controlling divine wisdom to make alterations in his precepts, dogmatically either to add some of their own or expunge any of his, And is it not a crime of the like reflection to alter them practically? When we will observe one part of the law, and not another part, but pick and choose where we please ourselves, as our humours and carnal interests prompt us, it is to change that part of the law, we charge that part of the law with folly, which we refuse to conform unto. The more cunning any man is in sin, the more his sin is against divine wisdom, as if he thought to outwit God. He that receives the promises of God and the testimony of Christ sets to this his seal that God is true, John 3:33. But the like strength of argument, it will undeniably follow that he that refuses obedience to his precepts sets to his seal that God is foolish. Were they not rational, God would not enjoin them. And if they are rational, we are enemies to infinite wisdom, but not complying with them. If infinite prudence had made the law, why not every part of it observed? If it were not made with the best wisdom, why is any part of it observed? If the defacing of his image be any sin, as being a defaming his wisdom in creation, the breaking his law is no less a sin, as being a disgracing his wisdom in his ministration. It is upon this account likely that the scriptures so often count sinners fools, since it is certainly inexcusable folly to contradict undeniable and infallible wisdom. Yet this is done in the least sin, and as he that breaks one tittle of the law is deservedly accounted guilty of the breach of the whole, James 2:10, so he that despises the least stamp of wisdom in the minutest part of the law is deservedly counted as a contemner of it in the frame of the whole statute book. But in particular, the wisdom of God is affronted and invaded. 1. By introducing new rules and modes of worship different from divine institutions, is not this a manifest reflection on this perfection of God? As though he had not been wise enough to provide for his own honour and model his own service, but stood in need of our directions and the capricios of our brains. Some have observed that it is a greater sin in worship to do that we should not than to omit what we should perform. One seems to be out of weakness because of the high exactness of the law, and the other out of impudence, accusing the wisdom of God of imperfection and controlling it in its institutions. At best it seems to be an imputation of human bashfulness to the supreme sovereign, as if he had been ashamed to prescribe all that was necessary to his own honour, but had left something to the ingenuity and gratitude of men. Man has, ever since the foolish conceit of an old ancestor, Adam, presumed he could be as wise as God, and if he who was created upright entertained such conceits, much more doth man now, under a mass of corruption, so capable to foment them. This hath been the continual practice of men, not so much to reject what once they had received as divine, but add something of their own inventions to it. The heathens renounced not the sacrificing of beasts for the expiation of their offences, which the old world had received by tradition from Adam, and the new world after the deluge from Noah, but they had blended that tradition with rites of their own, and offered creatures unclean in themselves, not fit to be offered to an infinitely pure being. For the distinction of clean and unclean was as ancient as Noah, Genesis 8:20, yea before, Genesis 7:2. So the Jews did not discard what they had received from God, as circumcision, the Passover, and sacrifices, but they would mix a heap of heathenish rites with the ceremonies of divine ordination, and practice things which had not been commanded, as well as things which had been enjoined to them. And therefore it is observable that when God taxes them with sin, he does not say they brought in those things which he had forbidden into his worship, but those things which he had not commanded, and had given no order for, to intimate that they were not to move a step without his rule. Jeremiah 7:31. They have built the high places of Tophet, which I commanded them not, neither came it into my heart. And Leviticus 10:1. Nadab's and Abihu's strange fire was not commanded, so charging them with impudence and rashness, and adding something of their own, after he had revealed to them the manner of his service, as if they were as wise as God. So loath is man to acknowledge the supremacy of divine understanding, and be sensible of his own ignorance. So after the divulging of the gospel, the corruptors of religion did not cling off, but preserved the institutions of God, but painted them, patched them up with pagan ceremonies, imposed their own dreams with as much force as the revelations of God. Thus hath the papacy turned the simplicity of the gospel into a pagan pomp, and religion into politics, and revived the ceremonial law, and raked some limbs of it out of the grave, after the wisdom of God had rung her knell, and honourably interred her, and sheltered the heathenish superstitions in Christian temples, after the power of the gospel had chased the devils, with all their trumpery, from their ancient habitations. Whence should this proceed, but from a partial atheism, and a mean deceit of the divine wisdom? As though God had not understanding enough to prescribe the form of his own worship, and not wisdom enough to support it, without the crutches of human prudence. Human prudence is too low to parallel divine wisdom. It is an incompetent judge of what is fit for an infinite majesty. It is sufficiently seen in the ridiculous and senseless rites among the heathens, and the cruel and devilish ones fetched from them by the Jews. What work will human wisdom make with divine worship, when it will presume to be the director of it, as a mate with the wisdom of God? Whence will it take its measures, but from sense, human fancy, as though what is grateful and comely to a depraved reason were as beautiful to an unspotted infinite mind? Do not tell the world that they were of God's covenant counsel, since they will take upon them to judge, as well as God, what is well pleasing to him. Where will it have the militia stop, if it hath the presumption to add any one thing to revealed modes of worship? How did God tax the Israelites with making idols according to their own understanding? Hosea 13:2. Imagining their own understandings to be of a finer make and a perfecter mould than their creators, and that they had fetched more light from the chaos of their own brains than God had from eternity in his own nature. How slight will the excuse be? God hath not forbidden this or that, when God shall silence men with the question, where or when did I command this or that? There was no addition to be made under the law to the meanest instrument God had appointed in his service. The sacred perfume was not to have one ingredient more put into it than what God had prescribed in the composition. Nor was any man upon pain of death to imitate it, nor would God endure that sacrifices should be consumed with any other fire than that which came down from heaven. So tender is God in any invasions of his wisdom and authority. In all things of this nature, whatsoever voluntary humility and respect to God that they may be disguised with, there is a swelling of the fleshy mind against infinite understanding, which the apostle nauseates, Colossians 2:18. Such mixtures have not been blessed by God, as God never prospered the mixtures of several kinds of creatures to form and multiply new species, as being a dissatisfaction with his wisdom as creator. So he doth not prosper mixtures in worship, as being a conspiracy against his wisdom as a lawgiver. The destruction of the Jews was judged by some of their doctors to be for preferring human traditions before the written word, which they ground on, Isaiah 29:33. Their fear for me was taught by the precepts of men, the injunctions of men were the rule of their worship, and not the precepts of my law. To conclude, such as make alterations in religion, different from the first institution, are intolerably busybodies. They will not let God alone with his own affairs. Vain man would be wiser than his maker. and be dabbling in that which is his sole prerogative. 2. In neglecting means instituted by God. When men have risings of heart against God's ordinances, they reject the counsel of the Lord against themselves, as in or in themselves, Luke 7:30. They disannul the wisdom of God, the spring of his ordinances. All neglects are disregards of divine prescriptions, as impertinent and unavailable to that end for which they were appointed, as not being suited to the common dictates of reason, sometimes out of a voluntary humility, such as Peter's was, when he denying Christ's condescension to wash his feet, John 13:8, and thereby judged of the comeliness of his master's intention and action. Such as continually neglect the great institution of the Lord's Supper, out of a sense of unworthiness, are in the same rank with Peter, and do, as well as use the means, but either means of their own appointment, or not at all the means of God's ordering. They would have God's wisdom and will consent to theirs, and not theirs conform to God's. As if our blind judgments were fit us to make the election of the path to happiness. Like Naaman, who, when he was ordered by the prophet for the cure of his leprosy, to wash 7 times in Jordan, would be the prophet's director, and having touched him with his hand, or if a patient, sick of a desperate disease, should prescribe to his skillful physician what remedies he should order for his cure, and make his own infirm reason, or his dust and palate, the rule, rather than a physician's skill. Men's inquiries are, who will show us any good? They rather fasten upon any means than that which God hath ordained. We invert the order divine wisdom hath established, when we would have God save us in our own way, not in his. It is the same thing as if we would have God nourish us without bread, and cure our diseases without disease, without medicines, and increase our wealth without our industry, and cherish our souls without his word and ordinances. This demand of him an alteration in his methods, and a separation of that which he hath by his eternal judgment joined together. Therefore, for a man to pray to God to save him, when he will not use the means he hath appointed for salvation, when he slights the word, which is the instrument of salvation, is a contempt of the divine wisdom of divine institutions. Also in omissions of prayer, when we consult not with God upon emergent occasions, we trust more to our own wisdom than God's, and imply that we stand not in need of his conduct, but of ability to direct ourselves and accomplish our ends without his guidance. Not seeking God is, by the prophet, taxed to be a reflection upon this perfection of God, Isaiah 31:1-2. They look not to the Holy One of Israel, neither seek the Lord, etc. And the like charge he brings against them, Hosea 8:9, they are gone up to Assyria, a wild ass alone by himself, not consulting God. 3. In censuring God's revelations and actions, if they be not according to our schemes, when we will not submit to his plain will without penetrating into the unrevealed reason of it, nor adore his counsels without controlling them, as if we could correct both law and gospel, and frame a better method of redemption than that of God's contriving. Thus men slighted the wisdom of God in the gospel, because it did not agree with that philosophical wisdom and reason they had sucked in by education from their masters, 1 Corinthians 1:21-22. Contrary to their practice in their superstitious worship, where the oracles they thought divine were entertained with reverence, not with dispute, and though ambiguous, were not counted ridiculous by the worshipper. How foolish is man in this wherein he would be accounted wise? Adam, in innocence, was unfit to control the doctrine of God when the eye of his reason was clear. And much more are we, since the deprivation of our natures. The revelations of God tower above reason in its purity, much more above reason in its mud and earthiness. The rays of divine wisdom are too bright for our human understanding, much more for our sinful understanding. It is base to set up reason, a finite principle, against an infinite wisdom. Much base is to set up a depraved and purblind reason against an all-seeing and holy wisdom. If we would have a reason for all that God speaks, and all that God acts, our wisdom must become infinite as his, or his wisdom become finite as ours. All the censures of God's revelations arise from some prejudicate opinions or traditional maxims that have thrown themselves in our minds, which are made the standard whereby we judge the things of God, and receive or reject them as they agree with or dissent from those principles. Colossians 2:8. Hence it was that the philosophers in the primitive times were the greatest enemies to the gospel, and the contempt of divine wisdom in making reason the supreme judge of divine revelation was the fruitful mother of the heresies in all ages springing up in the church, and especially of that Socinianism that daily insinuates itself into the minds of men. This is a wrong to the wisdom of God. He that censures the words or actions of another implies that he is, in essential, wiser than the person censured by him. It is insupportable to determine the truth of God's plain dictates by our reason, as it is to measure the suitableness or unsuitableness of his actions by the humour of our will. We may sooner think to span the sun, or grasp a star, to see a gnat swallow a leviathan, than fully understand the debates of eternity. To this we may refer two curious inquiries into divine methods, and intruding into those things which are not revealed, Colossians 2:18. It is to affect a wisdom equal with God, and an ambition to be of his cabinet council. We are not content to be creatures, that is to be every way below God, below him in wisdom as well as power.
This Reformation audio resource is a production of Stillwater's Revival Books. Many free resources, as well as our complete mail order catalogue containing classic and contemporary Puritan Reform books, CDs and much more at great discounts, are on the web at www.swrb.com. We can also be reached by email at swrb@swrb.com, by phone at 780-450-3730, by fax at 780-468-1096, or by mail at 4710-37A Avenue, Edmonton, AB, Canada, T6L3T5. If you do not have a web connection, please request a free printed catalogue. If you do have a web connection and would like to be added to our email list, please send an email to add@swrb.com or swrb@swrb.com with the word add in the subject line. SWRB's email list is a double opt-in list, so once you've sent us your email address, you will be asked by email to confirm you want to join our list using the email address you have supplied. Your email information will be kept confidential, and you can easily remove yourself from our email list by simply emailing us at swrb@swrb.com with the word remove in the subject line. Once you are on our email list, you will be alerted to all the new free Reformation resources, free MP3s, free electronic books and texts, etc. SWRB makes available on the web, as well as at times, to our best discounts and super specials. We also encourage you to reproduce this audio resource and to pass it on to your friends, but we only authorize this as long as the full contents of the message, including the header and trailer, is not altered in any way, and as long as the audio file or cassette is given away for free. Thank you again for listening to this SWRB reading, and remember that Isaiah 26:3 states, "Thou wilt keep him in perfect peace, whose mind is stayed on thee, because he trusteth in me. 2 Corinthians 13:11 concludes, finally, brethren, farewell. Be perfect. Be of good comfort. Be of one mind. Live in peace. And the God of love and peace shall be with you.